three-judge panel in Florida has ruled the judge in the George Zimmerman case should step aside. Matthew Petty of member station WMFE reports on why.
Florida's 5th District Court of Appeal in Daytona released their ruling on Wednesday, directing Judge Kenneth Lester to disqualify himself and requesting a new judge. Judge Lester had earlier dismissed a motion to remove himself from the case after defense attorneys claimed he made, quote, disparaging remarks about Zimmerman in a bond hearing. While ruling in favour of the defence, the appeal court judges said the decision was a close call. Zimmerman is facing a second-degree murder charge after he shot and killed teenager Trayvon Martin in February. For NPR News, I'm Matthew Petty in Orlando.
And I'm Paul Brown. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Nissan, featuring the redesigned Nissan Altima with 38 miles per gallon highway. Nissan. Innovation that excites.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
There's talk, and there's talk that matters. When you want to be part of a national conversation, turn to Talk of the Nation to hear experienced voices, informed views, and smart callers. We tackle the day's top stories and talk through the topics and issues that affect you. I'm Neil Cunningham. Join me for Talk of the Nation from NPR News starting Tuesday, September 4th at 1 p.m. on WILL AM 580.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind, we will not be taking calls.
There was a time in the early 20th century when scientists worried that many animal species were in danger of extinction, and they believed that the best way to preserve them was to put them in a museum, in exhibits that would show these animals as they had been in their home environments. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about an individual who became a leader in this effort, a man who has come to be called the father of modern taxidermy. His name was Carl Akeley, and his work is still on display today at museums in New York and in Chicago. In addition to being a taxidermist, he was also a sculptor, he was an inventor, and a nature photographer. And the story of his life is told in a new book that's just come out. The title of the book is Kingdom Under Glass. The subtitle, A Tale of Obsession, Adventure, and One Man's Quest to Preserve the World's Great Animals. Henry Holt is the publisher and the author. Our guest this morning, Jay Kirk. He's a writer. His nonfiction has been published in a number of places, Harper's, GQ, The New York Times Magazine, and The Nation. He teaches in the creative writing program at the University of Pennsylvania. The book is just out now, and it's a fascinating story, so I would certainly suggest that people take a look at it. Also, I do want to mention that he will be making an appearance at the Field Museum in Chicago tomorrow, November 6th at 1:30 in the afternoon, so people who are in and around the Chicago area can take advantage of that. And Mr. Kirk, hello.
Hello, David. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I was totally captivated by this story. It is remarkable. He's a remarkable figure. His wife and their relationship is remarkable. And I guess maybe also I connect to this because having grown up in the Chicago area and spent some time in the Field Museum, I am sure that I have seen the man's work. I wouldn't have known it when I was a boy going around looking at those exhibits, but I'm sure that I've seen it, and probably a lot of people listening to us have seen the animals that he collected and the work that he did there.
Absolutely. I think anyone who's ever been to the Field Museum or seen the famous African Hall of Mammals in New York at the American Museum of Natural History, you know, where there's that giant frozen herd of elephants in the middle of the hall, has seen Carl Akeley's work. Probably the most notable piece of his was one he constructed with his wife at the Field Museum, which are the two fighting bulls, the two elephants in the lobby, which is also on the stationery of the Field Museum.
Yeah, it's now in the big main hall there. These two elephants, he shot one of them. His wife shot the other one.
Exactly.
So they collected, and we'll have more to say about that. They collected the animals. And then also he really pioneered a method of preserving and recreating the animals that then a lot of people came along and did. I think about the fact that there was a time when in taxidermy, sort of the slang term for what people did was stuffing. People talked about having something stuffed.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of like what they did, but he took this to an entirely different level.
Yeah, well, stuffing is quite literally what they did. And Akeley, when he was a young taxidermy apprentice, he actually found himself pretty frustrated at the kind of crude methods of what they did, and he likened it to upholstery. And just, you know, the results of the animals were frequently pretty distorted and tragicomic sometimes, the way they would come out, because there wasn't an enormous amount of attention paid to the anatomy, you know, to the specific anatomy of the creatures. So these men were good at doing a number of things, but they hadn't really taken it to the next level, which is what Akeley did. By revolutionizing the method and through a number of different permutations that made it much more accurate in the end, where the animals really resemble what they resemble in real life. He used a combination of sculpting. I think that was his first real revelation. So, I mean, he really thought of himself as a fine artist, and I think in the end he truly is a great artist. It's just that he chose taxidermy to be his medium. But he sculpted these just remarkable mannequins, is what they were called. Instead of stuffing them, he would build the usual armature, which would be just the kind of rough dimensions of the animal, perhaps its leg bones and its skull attached to a metal rod, and then instead of roughing it out with, you know, rags and sawdust or whatever else they had around, he started building it up with clay. And he took so many meticulous measurements of each animal that he was going to recreate. I mean, just really countless measurements with calipers and tape measure, and he would make sketches and take note of where the veins were. And he had a very solid understanding of anatomy, too, like any masterful sculptor. And then he would sculpt it with clay until, you know, the clay mannequin in the end was just a beautiful piece of art. And then in the end, he would put the skin over that. Mm-hmm. That ultimately didn't work so well, so he actually, basically because any animal larger than a dog made of clay would be too cumbersome and heavy, and also that the skin had a tendency to kind of get corroded with the clay underneath it. So he finally resulted to using a method, and this was the real breakthrough, which was by making a cast mold of these beautiful clay sculptures. He would make it just like the lost wax method that famous bronze sculptors would use. So he would make a mold of it and then layer it with paper mache and this concoction that he had created. And then so in the end, what he had was a perfect replica, just like a Xerox copy of the clay sculpture, but in a much lighter and more durable form. So you could have that same verisimilitude with much larger animals, with hippopotamuses and ultimately elephants.
Yeah. The one thing that I think that it's difficult now for people to understand, and maybe you can help us get into the proper mindset, that is the mindset of people who would think that the best way to preserve a threatened animal species was to shoot it and mount it and put it in a museum.
It's ironic to say the least, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I actually found that particular question, that paradox, to really be one of the driving questions that kept me working on this book for 6 years. It was one of the most difficult struggles for me to completely wrap my head around, and I can admit it did take me a while to really get it myself. But as a writer, it was important for me to write the story as closely as possible from my character's points of view. I wanted it to kind of be subjective, like a read, not like a novel, I guess. Though it is not a novel, it is very much nonfiction. But I didn't want to, you know, kind of judge with my 20/20 hindsight, like what they were doing. I wanted to understand really where they were coming from. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, it's true that the scientists at these natural history museums really knew that many of these species, and we'll talk specifically about Africa, because of the scramble for Africa and the colonization and settlement that was taking place there, and the immense habitat loss and just the orgiastic killing of all of these animals was horrifying to these scientists, these naturalists who wanted to better understand them. But they saw that they were on the brink of extinction, and they thought, well, the best chance we have is to go over and get a couple samples and then bring them back and put them in our dioramas, so at least the people of the future will see what we've lost. I mean, interestingly enough, this is the thing. I mean, true conservation did not exist yet. It was just beginning to dawn as an idea. Mm-hmm. And historically, taxidermy, the purpose of these museums was to collect and catalog and name known species. It was just collecting it. The idea that the purpose of a museum might be to actually save the animals' lives rather than preserve their image just for the more abstract sake of knowledge hadn't really come along yet. So, yes, it was a great paradox. And in the end, that's probably Akeley's great redemption and his epiphany when he was collecting mountain gorillas in the Congo in 1921, and he realized that, in fact, he felt like a murderer. He realized what he was doing maybe wasn't the best way to go, and he realized that if something else wasn't done, that these mountain gorillas were going to be extinct. And that's why, toward the end of his life, he spent a great deal of time convincing the Belgian government, who had that colony, the Congo, to create what would be Africa's very first wildlife sanctuary, and Carl Akeley is definitely responsible for that and responsible for saving the mountain gorillas.
Yeah, so that's good. It's good. That's a sort of jumps to the end of the story, but in fact, it does show that eventually this contradiction we're talking about became even too much for him, and that that he was very important here in as you say, in persuading the government of Belgium to do something about it and to create the first nature reserve.
Yes. And a lot of it had to do, I mean, just to be fair again to their point of view, and I mean, I'm trying to make clear, you know, that the limitations that were set on them were the limitations of their own era and the limitations of their knowledge, and the limitations of the technology. I mean, the available technology at the time really had a lot to do with this. It was very difficult to get an accurate photograph of an animal in its natural habitat. You know, motion picture photography was very frustrating to use. Akeley, weirdly enough, actually took along a movie camera at the time. This was like in 1910. He was using it as a tool. He wanted to use it as a tool to make better taxidermy. And so he brought it along. This thing was like very cumbersome. It was basically like a big wooden suitcase mounted to a tripod. It was about as nimble, you know, trying to film a gazelle, trying to keep a gazelle in focus was like trying to keep a shooting star in focus in a child's toy telescope. I mean, it was just not useful at all. And he was incredibly frustrated. And so actually, it was during World War One when there was a hiatus on expeditions, and he was back in New York and in between working on his elephants and different work, he started tinkering with the motion picture camera. And in the end, he reinvented the motion picture camera to be used in the field, so that really, in the end, his own camera kind of obviated the need for his own beloved art form, taxidermy. So today we don't really need dioramas as much as, you know, we can see nature. That's what it was all about. I mean, the diorama so that we could see nature, but obviously, you know, great shows like the BBC Life series or Animal Planet or, you know, the many, or Nature on PBS. I mean, these programs, we take for granted because of the phenomenal technology and with movie cameras.
Yeah. Any day now, you can turn on the TV and you can see these fabulous nature documentaries. But at that time, that technology, it just didn't exist.
No, it certainly didn't exist.
And just again, I think it's important for people to understand the time period that we're again talking about. How people thought the time period we're talking about here. This is the late 19th, early 20th century, where the modern environmental movement, as we recognize it, is just getting started, and we're just starting to talk about things like creating national parks.
Exactly.
And so you have to be, I think, in thinking about him and looking at what he did and exploring these kind of questions, I think you have to be very careful about making sure that you place him in his time.
Absolutely. I think it's very important to keep that in mind. I mean, he was good friends with Teddy Roosevelt, who actually went to Africa with him in 1910. Carl Akeley convinced Roosevelt to go with him after he came out of office. And TR is kind of, he's a great example of that thinking of that time. You know, I mean, he greatly loved nature. You know, he worshipped it. But he was one of the first people to really see the writing on the wall, which was that, you know, America's natural resources were shrinking. Before that, I mean, the same things that were happening in Africa had already happened or were happening in the American West, where, you know, we'd thought forever. That was one of the great myths of America's wilderness, was that it was infinite. It went on forever, and we would have it forever. And people were just really waking up to the fact that maybe that's not the case. So, you know, people like Roosevelt, when he was creating the national park system, he was doing it out of, you know, a great love of nature for sure, but also for a very practical reason, which was to, you know, protect our shrinking resources. And so I think, you know, he was very much like Akeley in that, you know, they were both extremely paradoxical. You know, even though TR could go and do these wonderful things and create the national parks, he was also the sort of person who would, you know, go to Africa and get pretty trigger happy, which was unfortunate. But this is partly what made it kind of interesting for me to write, because I think these characters were so much on the fence. I mean, they're straddling two eras, where by now we take conservation for granted, and then they were kind of inventing it. It was just coming along.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Jay Kirk, and we're talking about his new book, Kingdom Under Glass, published by Henry Holt, and it is about the life of Carl Akeley, this man who many people regard as the father of modern taxidermy. He also was a sculptor. He was an inventor. He was a nature photographer, and a lot of the work that he did in the late 19th and early 20th century is still on display today. You can see it in museums in New York. You can see it in a museum in Chicago, where he worked for a number of years. And it's quite a fascinating story. We have someone here to talk with. We'll do that. And also want to tell other people who are listening, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's someone on a cell phone there in Milford. We'll go there. Line 4. Hello.
Yeah, David, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show. I'm guessing great minds think alike, because you gentlemen just about answered all my questions while I was on the line, so that's great. I actually had two questions. You draw the parallel to America, and my comment was going to be the wholesale slaughter of the buffalo, which I think is where you were probably headed with your comments. And then with TR, I know he was considered a great naturalist, and he set about going to Africa and basically shooting every type of animal that there was. So that's interesting. But my question was the gentleman self-taught as far as his methods of taxidermy? Was it trial and error, or did he ride the coattails of someone else? And can you tell me when he passed away? And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
Okay.
Sure. Great question. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, he died in 1926. I'll work backward. He died in 1926, and the way he learned taxidermy, he actually started as a young boy, as did, coincidentally enough, Teddy Roosevelt. They were both practicing taxidermy when they were just kids, and it's one of the more interesting parts of Carl's youth that he practiced it so obsessively up in his bedroom, and he had all of these, you know, kind of dead animals and skins and gruesome things laid out all over his room while he was practicing and learning. He had bought a taxidermy manual for $1 out of the back of a magazine called Youth's Companion, and that's how he learned it first. And I'll just continue this about his family's impression of his chosen art form, that his aunt, a close aunt who lived around the corner from them, had become so disturbed at Akeley's obsessive, morbid obsession up in his bedroom that she tried to persuade his parents to send him to an insane asylum. They thought it was so odd. But, I mean, and the fact of the matter is, like, many young naturalists were using taxidermy as children, you know. He kind of went hand in hand with being a taxidermist, with being a naturalist. Then he went on to work for an outfit in Rochester, which was kind of the main supplier of exhibits for natural history museums, which were new to the country. They were just kind of popping up around that same time. And, I mean, they did everything there. I mean, they did the taxidermy, they collected fossils, they collected gemstones, the whole deal. It was called Ward's Natural Scientific Establishment. I think that's the correct name. So he went there, with the skills that he'd picked up from that little taxidermy manual in the back of Youth's Companion, and went and found that they hadn't really advanced it much beyond that. There were, and thus he was kind of frustrated with it, and I think from the very beginning really wanted to take it to the next level. He wanted to do something new. He felt like it had a lot of growth potential. There were a number of other young taxidermists who were making headway also in different directions, but Akeley is definitely the one who kind of took it all and made it what it was. And your other question?
Well, I think that was essentially it. He wanted to know, well, how it was he learned this. Was he self-taught? And the other question was when he died.
Yes.
And that was 1926. And then it was in Africa. And in fact, he's buried in Africa.
He is, yeah, up on in the Congo, where he went with a crew of artists. He took the background painters. These were a number of some of the country's best landscape painters he took with him. He wanted them to see firsthand exactly what these, the background paintings, the scenery would look like. So to get the studies, he actually had this, small army of preparators and artists who trudged up to the top of these volcanoes just to get the art. I mean, that's one of the aspects of this book that always just made me love the characters so much and love the whole story behind it. I mean, it was like, just Akeley as the obsessive artist, not that he was risking his life over and over and over again for his art, and he was even killing for his art. So that level of obsession certainly caught my attention early on. Even though in the end, I think there finally much larger questions emerged, which we already talked about
sure.
a little bit.
Well, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here on our toll-free line in LaSalle County. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello. Interesting discussion. I've seen some pretty ratty examples of taxidermy around here, and I've noticed that they start to smell, and I think that they start to biodegrade, and I wonder if the author knows, or I have one other comment that, well, I was a little kid around 6 or 7 or 8 or whatever, and I walked into the Field Museum and I saw the elephant, and I was just blown away, because it's so huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're so close to it. But my question is, how long, if the author looked into this, how long did they think that these examples of taxidermy will last that he created. And I'll hang up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, they've already been there for
quite a long time.
Quite a long time.
Elephants.
Yeah.
I think he did those in 1907. The ones that are in the lobby, the Four Seasons, which is also at the Field Museum in Chicago, which are kind of his first real piece de resistance, is a series of a group of deer done in four separate dioramas by each season. So there's spring, summer, fall, and winter. Just incredible piece. It's almost a suite of the seasons, and each one is done so meticulously. And he started that in the mid 1890s, 1894, and I think they finished it. He and his wife Mickey built that together. She handmade all of the leaves. They were cast wax models. They would literally go and take an impression, you know, a mold of a leaf, a mold of a fern, and then pour wax into it and put the dye in and use a little metal stem. And I mean, she made something along the lines of 20,000 or 30,000 leaves just for that. That's how meticulous they were. But that was finished in 1902, so that's been around for quite a long time. And I don't think they're afraid of it decaying anytime soon. But you probably wouldn't want to be anywhere near one of those dioramas when they took the pane of glass off, because there's a lot of arsenic in there.
So they did indeed use chemicals to try to stabilize the organic parts.
Yes, yes, very much so. Yeah. We were trying to figure out I was there on a trip a year or two ago. We were trying to figure out what the snow was, and it turned out there was a document that was sugar, so we assumed it had to have been sugar laced with arsenic. I mean, otherwise it didn't really make sense. But yeah. I mean, the tanning methods were extensive, you know, and then that plus quite a bit of arsenic, and then they're sealed in these basically, you know, hermetically sealed cases, and they don't open them up very often.
That must have been, you know, you described the process. So in these, we have deer that are mounted, but then everything else in there, trees, grass, insects, leaves, everything was made. And as you said, his wife made these thousands of leaves individually cast in wax and then painted, and this put together. And it must have been stunning for people to see it. There wasn't anything like it before. There had been never anything like this.
It's its own art form. I'm still, when I go and look at any of the dioramas, I feel like I'm just as amazed and mesmerized by the foliage as the animals themselves. I mean, it's just they're beautiful. They suspend your disbelief, you know. Mm-hmm. And it has that wonderful quality, you know, of being handmade. It has that artisanal quality. I just think there's nothing quite like them. They are fascinating.
Yeah. Well, we definitely should talk. You should talk about Mickey, about his first wife, and so she was somebody who was a remarkable character, I think, in her own right, and certainly was a very important partner for him in this work.
Absolutely. Mickey, yeah, the book, I mean, I feel like the book is sounding like it's just about Carl Akeley, but it is not. It's about Carl and Mickey Akeley and their marriage, their extremely adventurous marriage. He first met her when she was only 13. She'd run away from her farm in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, just a very hot-headed young girl, ran away all the way to Milwaukee. They met in Milwaukee. That's where Carl actually did some of his first dioramas can be seen there. The actual habitat dioramas are in Milwaukee. And so they met there. She married a friend of his who was a barber, supposed hunting partner, and then she quickly left the barber for the taxidermist. And then was just mesmerized with his work. They fell in love, and she became his, you young bride assistant working on these things together. She would go off on her own on these very long trips up into the northern woods of Wisconsin to collect, clods of dirt and trees and ferns and sticks and all these things to bring back. You know, she'd go up and she'd make molds of them, or she'd bring them back on the train all by herself just for the diorama. She was deeply committed to his work and him. I think they were deeply committed to each other. Things probably went a little sour after their first or second, their second safari together in 1910. That's where a lot of kind of insane things happened, where he had a incredibly violent collision with an elephant that nearly killed him. It was one of the sensational parts of the story I remember reading about and thinking, this can't possibly be true. I mean, he was near the top of Mount Kenya. He'd kind of become so obsessed trying to get the perfect bull specimen for his for the diorama back in New York at this point. He was kind of like Ahab searching, looking for his Moby Dick. And he was near the top of Mount Kenya. It was just below the glacier. His hands were freezing cold and numb. He could barely hold his rifle. And then he started to gradually realize that he was being hunted as well by this elephant. And then just out of nowhere, a tusk appeared right at his chest. And he did the kind of unimaginable, and he threw his rifle aside. He grabbed a hold of the tusk, and then he got around in between and grabbed the other tusk as it lifted him up into the air, so that he's basically riding this elephant like a gargantuan bicycle with an arm around each tusk, and he's, looking into its eye. You can see his own reflection in its eye. And then it plows him into the ground, and for, being a root or a rock underground, he wasn't instantly squished like a grape. But then, Mickey then went on her own sort of insane and terrifying and hard-to-believe rescue mission, which is a rather large scene in the book, where because she had been left behind down at base camp with their marriage was kind of going through a little tension. And he'd gone on that hunt by himself. He'd left Mickey behind at base camp with the rest of their safari party, so the 150 or so porters and gun bearers and skinners and everyone like that. And then she had to convince them to go at midnight while it was raining, to go up to the top of the mountain after the runners had come down to report that Akeley had just had this collision with the elephant. And she had a near mutiny. Someone tried to kill her in the middle of it all. But somehow she had the fortitude and force of personality to have these men help her get up to the top, and she found Akeley. He had his chest caved in. When she first saw him, she thought he was dead. He was just like a pulp of blood covered in ants. And then he had his chest was caved in. He'd broken several ribs. He'd been crudely scalped by the elephant. His whole right side of his face was ripped off so that his teeth were kind of gruesomely, he had this gruesome grimace. But then, and amazingly, instead of returning to America and to, a cozy hospital, clean sheets and running water, Akeley was still so obsessed with finding his perfect bull that he would stay there for 3 more months, just convalescing in his cot. While Mickey continued going out hunting for elephants. And then when Carl finally healed physically, he still had this elephant hunt to go on, but he found out that he'd kind of had a collapse of his morale, in the gentle euphemism of the time. He was having nervous breakdowns and fainting and just kind of... I think a modern diagnosis would probably be post-traumatic stress disorder. I think hunting elephants is pretty stressful work. And so Mickey actually took up the cause and helped him get these elephants. And I think in the end, probably the safari lifestyle is not really the best thing for one's mental well-being. And it
Yeah.
It had a strain on both of them and certainly had a strain on their marriage in the end.
Yeah, there's a photograph here of the aftermath of this that's in the book. That's him in a, looks like in a cot, and his head is all bandaged up. He looks like the mummy, and he's sitting there. He's sort of sitting up in bed, and he's holding a mirror, and he's looking at himself. And you can just see his head is all wrapped up in bandages, and his eyes are cut, are open and uncovered, and his mouth is there. But you can just, it's sort of stunning just to look at this photograph, and then to think about what it is that the guy had been through.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's remarkable that he would stay on. I think like anyone else would be like, okay, well, I tried. Now I'm going home.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know?
Well, and you also tell the story. I believe it was that you actually got on to Akeley. You were writing a magazine piece. You were writing a magazine piece about the mountain lion.
Yeah.
Which officially is extinct in the eastern U.S., except in recent years there are people who say that they've seen them. So,
yeah.
So in the course of that, you read the story about a famous taxidermist who once strangled a leopard with his bare hands. This was Carl Akeley. And in fact, there's a photo, it's in the book, and it's one that you see a lot in articles about him, a picture of him standing next to the leopard, which is dead, hanging by its back feet, and he's standing there beside it, and his hands are all bandaged up. And you just, it's almost too cinematic to be real. But it's real.
Yeah, you sort of think, well, you sort of had that coming to you, didn't you? You know, go to Africa and try and kill all these marvelous animals, and they fought back. Well, good for them, you know.
Yeah.
But that was a remarkable story. That is the first thing that turned me onto it. I was working for a Harper's story about mountain lions and cougars, and I was reading about it. It kind of goes back to one of your caller's questions about. He mentioned the bison, and I was reading about, you know, that period, and then even later, there was almost this systematic wipeout, execution of, you know, coyotes and wolves and cougars and all of these animals that we now consider extremely charismatic, maybe just for their scarcity. But at that time, we wiped them all out, and the cougar had gone extinct by 1888, but there still seems to remain more sightings of it than Elvis in the eastern U.S. And it's always made me wonder, like, what causes that? Is it, you know, that we maybe need more wilderness? But yeah, it was while reading that I just read in passing that little detail about Carl and his leopard.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus is Jay Kirk. He's a writer. His works, nonfiction works, been published in a number of places, Harper's, GQ, New York Times Magazine, The Nation. He's the author of a new book that is about the life of this man that we're talking about here, Carl Akeley. Also very much about his partner in many of these exploits, his wife, Mickey. The title of the book, Kingdom Under Glass, a tale of obsession, adventure, and one man's quest to preserve the world's great animals. It's published by Henry Holt. And as we've mentioned a couple of times, his work is still on display. It's at the Field Museum in Chicago. It's at the Museum of Natural History in New York. So the work is still there and can be seen. I did mention, I think, both of us maybe mentioned that he was a sculptor. You know, one of the things that I was, that sort of delighted me to be reconnected with was last night, or was yesterday, as I was looking around for information about him on the web, and you can see a number, there are photographs of him on safari and in the workshop and so forth, and I did not realize that there's a sculpture that's at the Field Museum that's still there that I was captivated by as a kid. It's the Lion Hunters. And I know you know that, and it's a sculpture of three African men hunting lions, and it's sort of in two parts. And there's one part where, and it's life size. There are these three hunters confronting these lions, and then there's a second piece that's them sort of standing around the lion that they've killed. And I remember when I was a kid seeing those and thinking something about it was just the coolest thing
that's so cool
ever. And they're life size, so you, back in the day, and I guess pretty much now, you can pretty much just stand beside these guys.
Yeah.
almost like you were standing there beside these guys after the hunt. It's a beautiful piece, and I was captivated by it when I was a kid, and I hadn't thought about that in years, but suddenly I see this picture of these guys, and I think, I know those guys.
Yeah.
And that sculpture was something that he did.
Yes, he. I know exactly what you're talking about. There are three Nandi spearmen, and it's kind of connected back to that his frustration with the motion picture camera. That was kind of like the point where he became the most frustrated with the available technology in terms of the movie camera he had, and he wanted to film these Nandi. Doing a traditional lion spearing ceremony. And so he set it up, and he wanted to, you know, film it. He was doing some anthropology. And he filmed it, and he could not keep the action in the camera in focus at all. You know, I mean, the lion would repeatedly fall out of the screen. And, you know, I mean, it's just one of those points where the camera didn't do what he wanted it to do, and he was very frustrated with it. And so among the innovations that he made when he, a few years later, when he started reinventing it, was a gyroscopic hinge that connected the camera to the tripod, and then he added a different kind of handle. The camera was round, and it had a he had it such that you could follow the action with great nimbleness and really follow it, which really changed cinematography quite a bit. Almost to the point that at the I don't remember what year it was, but when Man of War ran in the Kentucky Derby, and people saw it in the newsreels, you know, before a movie, and it had been filmed with Akeley cameras, two Akeley cameras mounted on either side of the racetrack. But when people saw this, they were completely blown away. I mean, they had no idea how the camera was following the horse that quickly. And they thought, some people thought that the cameras must have been attached to airplanes or attached to a car speeding around the track at the same time. I mean, because, you know, they had never seen anything like it. So I always found that very fascinating that the guy who'd kind of perfected one art form of taxidermy for capturing wildlife, or at least preserving an image of it, in the end, reinvent the technology that would enable us to preserve them in real life. And, you know, I think by the very end, when he was hunting for the mountain gorillas, he started to realize, because he had his camera, and he took the first motion picture photography ever of mountain gorillas, and it's beautiful footage. And I think part of him must have realized he didn't really need a gun quite as much anymore now that he had a camera. Yeah.
You talked a little bit earlier about Mickey and about their somewhat strange relationship, and also about her involvement in the work and how difficult this was emotionally for both of them. I can't let you get away without at least talking a little bit about JT Jr. and about the role that he maybe played in their relationship and maybe even had some role in their relationship coming apart.
Maybe a little bit, yeah.
A little bit, maybe.
Maybe. One day they're on safari. They're having this kind of classic safari-style lunch, you know. And they got into an argument about the morality of keeping animals in zoos. Specifically, they were arguing about monkeys. And Carl and the other two men who were there, their companions, were basically saying that they thought that monkeys were inherently filthy, dirty, little, mischievous beasts. And Mickey was arguing that, no, they're like that because they've been, you know, dehumanized would be the wrong word, but because they're in captivity, you know. But in the wild, they were happier and cleaner and more dignified, I suppose. So to prove her point, she went out and she captured a little vervet monkey. And her plan was to bring it back to camp, and she would keep it in captivity for a couple of days, prove her point, and then let it go. Well, she fell in love with it right away, and she named it. She gave it a name, JT Jr., after one of their companions, who was JT Mikuchian, who was a famous cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune back then, who was along on the safari, and who actually wrote one of the best accounts of their expedition together called In Africa. So she adopted this monkey, and then soon Carl found that she didn't want him in her cot, in her tent at night, because she was protecting the monkey and trying to keep it warm, and also that she was justifying keeping the monkey because she wanted to continue conducting these scientific observations of its nature, and that included recording night sounds that it made, and so she wanted to keep it in her bed with her at night. And then when they got back to New York, she really just... She doted on it so much and became so obsessed with the monkey that she basically let her social life fall apart, and she would not go out, and she would always use the excuse that she had to stay behind with JT Jr. So yeah. I don't want to totally spoil the end, but yes, that did have a deleterious effect on their marriage.
Well, and I think that maybe one should be careful about reading too much into this particular story, but I think that she wrote an autobiography when she gave her account of her life experiences. And I do think that is true that later in her life she did say something about maybe one of her great regrets was that she never had children.
I never have actually read her stating that overtly, but I think it was very easy to read into that for a number of reasons. I mean, I felt I ran into it constantly. Mm-hmm. JT Jr. was not the only thing she adopted. I mean, she tried to adopt a young native child once whose parents had ran away, terrified when Akeley's safari came storming down the mountain, and had momentarily hidden the child under a bed of ferns. And Mickey quite quickly picked up the child and said, I'll take care of it, and we can take care of it. And while the rest of the safari party was kind of frantically trying to get the parents to come back, which fortunately they did, there was a lot to read between. I don't ever remember her saying, you know, explicitly that that's what it was about. But I think to say that she had a maternal instinct is a fairly sound inference to be made.
Yeah, I think there's a story in the book about a young boy, a Kikuyu boy, who kind of volunteered himself to become part of their party, which she kind of adopted. Named him Bill.
Yeah, Bill. She adopted Bill.
And then, in fact, last night, I was looking at some of these old photos, and here I came across a picture of Bill and JT Jr.
Yeah, yeah.
Bill is holding JT Jr.
Yeah, she had actually appointed one of the other children that was part of the safari. His name was Ali, and she appointed him to be just as an example of how much she doted on JT Jr. She appointed Ali as a JT Jr.'s personal valet, and among his responsibilities were to carry an umbrella around for him all day so he wouldn't get too much sun, and to give him a bath every night. He was a spoiled brat, the monkey.
They're just remarkable characters. They really are, and the more I read of them, they just seemingly the more remarkable and kind of larger than life they become.
Absolutely, I fell completely in love with both Akeley's, and there was a lot to sink my teeth into in terms of the historical things and the aspects of the bigger questions of conservation and all that. But in the end, for me, it was just about completely loving these characters. Pretty hard to spend 6 years working on a book unless you really like the characters, and I'm glad they left as much of a record of their lives so I could revisit it and write about it myself.
Yeah, you wonder though what really it would have been like to actually be with these people. What were they like as people, and were they so obsessed? And that's the word that you use in the subtitle, and it's probably pretty fair. I'm so obsessed with what they were doing that they might not have been real pleasant to be with.
I've read an enormous amount of the correspondence, the things that you're able to read. I found a great kindness and humor in Akeley, and I always adored Mickey. from her own writings. I thought she was lovely, you know, mildly eccentric, but I really wouldn't be interested in them if they weren't. Certainly workaholic. I mean, Akeley's the original workaholic, and I think that's the obsession part of it. And I know he could sometimes be brutal, but in the end, I think he had an enormous number of friends and admirers, and just a great sense of humor.
Well, and it seems that he was someone who was so his dedication to this vision that he had of what he was trying to do with the art, and I think it's certainly fair to say that it was art. This combination of science, art, craft, that he was when he was doing that, he was putting everything he had into it, and it seems that was something that was in him to do from the point that he was really quite young. Going back to that story about how his aunt thought he should be in an institution because there just seemed to be something too strange about it, that it was something that he poured everything into.
Yes, very, very much so. Even to the point that I think he was, you know, it was the one thing that I came away with regarding Akeley's character is that I think a lot of folks who might be obsessed or driven, you know, in that way can often be kind of egomaniacs, or there's an aspect that's, you know, not so sympathetic, and that it's all about their ego, or but he really was not like that, and in that way he was very likable, and I think, I mean, even to the point, I think he was just so dedicated and loved what he did so much that he poured himself into it. But he, you know, even to the point where he didn't end up taking credit for a lot of the things he was doing, just because he was so busy trying to do it right and to perfect it. And he would have friends trying to persuade him, like, Carl, you have to patent this. You have to take credit for what you're doing. I mean, you are, you know, you're revolutionizing this whole field. And I guess, I mean, he was less concerned with getting credit and making a name for himself than he was with just doing what he loved.
Yeah. So that you said you spent 6 years on this project. After this, where do you go from this for another story to write that's as big as this? Is there something?
I'm working on a couple of different ideas right now. I'm not sure if it'll be as big as Akeley, but I might write a couple of magazine stories for a while. But I have a few ideas. I'm not sure. Not sure quite yet. Maybe I'll write a book about J.T. Jr.
Our guest in this hour, Jay Kirk. And if you want to read the book, and it's a great story, the title of the book is Kingdom Under Glass. The subtitle is A Tale of Obsession, Adventure, and One Man's Quest to Preserve the World's Great Animals, published by Henry Holt, all about the life of Carl Akeley. Jay Kirk has written for Harper's, GQ, New York Times Magazine, The Nation, and I want to mention one more time that he will be giving a talk at the Field Museum in Chicago tomorrow afternoon at 1:30.
I should say it's at 1 p.m.
At 1 p.m. tomorrow, and that's a place where you can still today see Akeley's work. Wait, thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square this Saturday morning at 7, featuring Illinois-grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2319. Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets as we head into the last few hours of trading for this Thursday. And we begin in the soybean pit, where in the last hour or so, soybeans have made new all-time highs. In September and November, the two contracts I'm currently looking at on the screen And we've eclipsed the highs, the all-time highs that we made earlier this week on the 27th of August. And monthly charts, too, showing strength in the beans, with the possibility of, technically speaking, beans moving up closer to that $18 benchmark. Although we do have a long weekend coming up, a three-day weekend, and as it, we look at that, and the other pits, traders are moving essentially around unchanged to down to unchanged to up as they hover around that unchanged level, probably a little bit hesitant to extend gains.